Thank you.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the latest episode of the You Should Run podcast. My name is Tony Heil, council member in Bridgeport, Pennsylvania, and if you've been listening to past episodes, and I hope that you have, you know that I've been talking with interesting people from all across the country, at all levels of government, from borough council like myself, and I do talk to myself too much, of course, up to mayor and state representative and even Congress, and I'm also trying to talk to at least one, hopefully more, interesting person or people in every state. And I have yet to talk to someone from Oregon. I know some people in Oregon, but I've yet to have a guest on my podcast from Oregon. And that changes today with an extraordinary person who's running for state legislature there who has a unique perspective that none of my other 70-plus guests have had when it comes to the COVID pandemic. And she's going to be explaining, you know, why she's running, why you should run for office, and, you know, hopefully how she can make a difference in the state legislature. Please follow along at You Should Run Pod, follow on Facebook, share this, and leave me messages to amplify this. But with that in mind, I am excited to introduce Dr. Lisa Reynolds. Dr. Reynolds, thank you for talking.
Thank you. First of all, please call me Lisa, and thank you, Tony, for having me on. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Great. I never know when someone's a doctor. I don't want to downplay that. Because if I was a doctor, I would insist that people just call me. So this is the You Should Run podcast. You've listened to some of them before. I always want to ask people, when did you first feel invested or pay attention to politics and how it affected you?
You know, so I am a pediatrician. I've been a pediatrician for over 20 years here in Portland, Oregon. And, you know, I would say in this past decade, as I felt like I had a front hand seat, or front row seat, I guess, as to what was working and not working for Oregon families. And what concerned me the most was the achievement gap, which I felt had been kind of widening over my time in practice of, you know, kids who seem to really be excelling, getting it, advancing, and then other kids who seem to really be lagging behind, and which just seems to amplify the longer you're in school. If you're falling behind in third grade, you're really behind in fifth grade. Mm-hmm. And so I felt like I wanted to do more for my patients than what I could accomplish in the exam room. And then, like so many people, I was very upset, angry, frustrated with gun violence in the U.S., you know, after the shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School, and then in 2016, yes, here in Oregon, we had a shooting at a community college that left 10 people dead. And so I got involved with Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense. And mm-hmm. those of you who know anything about moms, it is organizing 101. It teaches you everything you need to know to have a real impact, especially at the state legislative level. And I got pretty involved and took leadership roles with that organization and saw how important it was for citizen activism. And kind of those two roles came together for me. And I thought, you know, I think I bring an important experience and perspective. And now I have quite a skill set in order to run for office and to be a legislator. And so here I am.
Yeah, you mentioned Moms Demand Action. And I have seen that in our state in Pennsylvania. They go to the legislature, and they are extremely well organized, where there's been a lot of gun groups, both pro you know, gun safety, or, you know, keeping guns out of the hands of people who shouldn't have them. That does seem like they are uniquely well organized to teach people to be political organizers.
Yes, it's an amazing organization. It has spawned a lot of candidates and politicians, including Lucy McBath, who lost her son to gun violence, is now a U.S. representative from Georgia in the district that used to be represented by Newt Gingrich. So there, it's definitely, I think it's been an amazing organization for that level, as well as for passing a lot of great gun laws at the state level and blocking a lot of bad gun laws at the state level. We certainly, as you guys probably all know, we haven't made much inroads at the federal level, but certainly at state by state, Moms Demand Action has been very successful.
And I know that people look at Oregon, they look at Washington State, they look at the West Coast, and they have a certain vision of it. But there is a big gun culture out there, right? So it's not like you just go into the legislature or you go into the public in Oregon and say, we want to change the gun laws, and it's 100% agreement. Like, it's still a struggle politically.
Oh, it is really a struggle. This is the third year that we have failed to advance a law that would require that guns are locked when they're not in use, which to me, most people are like, that makes so much sense. Well, it's our third year of failing to do that. So that's frustrating. And I think, you know, we also sometimes get frustrated here in Oregon, and I'm sure other states, that we're making advances on gun violence prevention. Absolutely. Almost every year we've passed a law. It does feel pretty incremental, and kind of better than nothing. And we're saving lives every year. But I would love to see more wide sweeping legislation at the federal level. And, you know, we're certainly hoping for that if we prevail, if the Democrats prevail in November.
Yes. And you also, like you said, you have been working on the achievement gap and seeing what's going on with kids. How does your perspective as a pediatrician versus other professions, obviously I can guess how a doctor is going to know this, but, you know, what have you seen? How have you noticed that in your profession?
Well, what I've certainly seen is, I think, you know, even at the kindergarten level of kids who are entering the school system at kindergarten who seem better prepared, kindergarten ready is kind of the buzzword, than other kids. And we know that that literally translate into third grade reading scores and high school graduation rates and, you know, hopefully rewarding careers with living wages. So what I see in my practice is the kids who kind of start out in kindergarten, you know, are not really ready for that, whether it's that they didn't have a robust pre-kindergarten program, or whether there's been some childhood trauma for which they're still struggling with. So the mental health issue is a really big part of it, especially I think in early childhood. And you can just kind of see it sometimes in the kids' eyes with how they talk about school, how they think about school, their comfort and confidence in talking about things. And we know, you know, different parents have their own personal and financial resources for what they can offer their kids when it comes to schooling. And there's quite a bit of disparity there. So I think the reality right now, and this is pre-COVID even, is that this, you know, we're really hoping that the schools can do even more in Oregon. And they're certainly trying to. We passed some landmark legislation in 2019 to improve funding to schools, including in the mental health realm. So I think those are all things in an effort to close the achievement gap, you know, and to hopefully kind of level the playing field a bit on equity issues.
Yeah, I mentioned before we started talking about my four-year-old son, but I also have a six-year-old son who just finished kindergarten, I guess you can say, because like so many others, they missed out. But, you know, his teacher was telling, oh, he's so wonderful. This was months before the school ended. Like, he's ready for first grade now. And, you know, that makes me feel proud for him. But I also know that if he's ready, it doesn't mean that everyone else in the class is at that same level. And, you know, he's lucky because he's got two parents that read to him and take him to museums or take him to the zoo. And not everyone has that ability.
Right. Yes.
So, but you just said pre-COVID. I'm sure your campaign, when you started thinking about running for office, you were not thinking about COVID-19.
No. I mean, I will say that, you know, the medical aspect of, you know, being a pediatrician, besides, of course, you know, the issues around child, you know, just child health and child well-being and kindergarten readiness, you know, I, you know, when we look at our state budget here in Oregon, it's probably not different in other states. 27% of our state budget goes to healthcare, or at least it did pre-COVID. It's only going to go higher. And, you know, I kind of argued that, you know, we have very few healthcare experts in the legislature. We have a lot of other fields that are more widely kind of covered in the legislature, including people with deep educational background. But before this primary, we had one physician, a state senator, and one nurse practitioner out of 90. So I definitely was arguing that. I think it's time for more medical expertise in a state that spends almost a third of its budget on healthcare. And then, yes, when COVID happened, I continued to make that case, and I think that did resonate with voters.
I don't know how it couldn't. And
you're right.
You know, in Pennsylvania, we have 203 members of the state house and 50 senators. And we have, I think there's one state senator out of 50 that is a nurse, has a background in healthcare. And then there's two people with a healthcare background out of 203 in the state house. And that's, wow. And that's new. That's not like, that's been there for a while. And I can see that there's a lot of lawyers in the legislature. That's for sure. Nothing against lawyers.
Yeah. So, right.
So how quickly did you know that you were going to have to take a legislative position on COVID? Like, what did you see early on in your background that you wanted to see addressed, in the legislature as a result of this?
Oh boy, we all remember those days, right? Kind of March 8th, March 10th, at least here in Oregon. And I think it hit the West Coast first, although New York started pretty early as well. And I know, I'm sure it had an impact on Pennsylvania, but you know, by March 6th, 7th, 8th, group of physicians and I were getting pretty concerned because of growing number of cases in Seattle. We're getting pretty concerned about what Oregon's response would be. And I would say that a group of us who've become activists, you know, just separate of me running for office, and another physician in this group actually is running for office too, actually is serving right now. That was Dr. Dexter. We started calling on the governor. We started calling for school closures. We started calling for physical distancing. We started calling for closing businesses. And I will say early on, people thought we were a little crazy and overreacting, including some of my partners in my practice. By March 12th, because it was Friday the 13th, it was actually the last day of school here in Oregon. And I think the physicians who spoke up to the governor, if we didn't persuade her as much as we gave her cover to take really bold actions, and I think that's been credited with having a significant, at least early impact on flattening the curve here in Oregon. And we just kept doing things like that. Then we started calling for stay home orders. Then we called for masking. So it's been a group of physicians who've been activists in this arena, loud, early, and often. And I think I'm proud of that work. And then, you know, on social media, I felt like I had to distill a lot of scientific information for my future constituents or for whoever was following me on social media. It's what we do as physicians every single day in the exam room. You know, you try to kind of in your head distill down what you understand about ear infections and explain that to families so we can make the best decision about whether this child truly needs antibiotics or not. So I actually started a blog called Oregon Coronavirus Update in early March because it was really hard to find information kind of coalesced in one place where people could understand what's going on. So, I mean, I probably would have done a lot of this stuff had I not been running for office, but I certainly felt like I had this public platform now. And so I took it, and I continue to take it very, very seriously that I know people look to me for, you know, my thoughts or musings or, you know, my interpretation of the latest scientific news. And I'm, you know, I take it very seriously, and I think it's provided some guidance for people.
And, you know, talking to someone like you with a medical background and expertise, I'm sure that under normal circumstances, you take time to distill information for yourself to understand. There'll be a journal that comes out one month and then something else the next month that changes that or reinforces it, and then years after years. And yet the information about this, because it is the issue, just keeps changing constantly, right? Or am I wrong that it's not changing, it's just the conversation's changing?
No, I think you're right that a lot of the information is definitely changing and evolving. Mm-hmm. You know, I had been hearing for a while that kids can't get COVID, and I was really frustrated by that. But I will tell you, I'm looking at the science, and I do think right now, what we know right now, asterisk, this could change, is that kids definitely can get COVID, but they seem to be less susceptible to it than an adult. And kids seem to be spreading it at a lower rate than an adult does. And I was very skeptical about these assertions a month ago, but there's been enough observational studies that suggest that to be the case, and that has huge implications for school. Mm-hmm. But I had to be really persuaded of that. So absolutely, the science is changing. I think we all have our own even confirmation bias when we look at science. I'll be honest. I was like, how could people say kids can't get COVID? It makes no sense. But I am seeing that the numbers seem to add up that, again, kids seem to be a little bit less susceptible. So yes, things are going to be changing. And I think that's hard for the public. It's funny. It feels kind of easy to me because I think I'm used to that. You know, there's new data. We have to change what we do. We do this all the time in medicine. Obviously, it's really, really compressed, you know, with what we've learned in the past 5 months about COVID. But I have less discomfort with that than I think other people might.
That, well, as a parent, that makes me happy. We got our daycare opened up, and our kids have been in daycare for the last month, and it's been going well. I haven't come face-to-face with an adult the whole time I've been there. They've been doing distancing between adults. But the way you mention it, I imagine you feel, and your expertise, like, you might want to feel more cautious than, like, my neighbor, who will just take things as it goes and just go on the next theory. But if you sound more, not politically liberal, but just, you know, open to anything, you might give people false comfort. And that's something you definitely don't want to do.
Right. No, I think you're absolutely right. There's got to be a lot of evidence for something before we kind of change how we think about our approach to COVID, for sure.
So, and you talk on your website, and you also mentioned here about mental health. I'm sure that you, as a pediatrician, have been very concerned about the mental health of young people throughout this, which is something I don't know how to grasp. I don't know what to say about it or do about it.
Yeah, it is rough. And as you probably saw on my website, you know, I have a severely mentally ill brother, and the mental health crisis, you know, in our country and our mental health workforce shortage here in Oregon is one of the reasons, another reason why I decided to run. I felt we need to really think about how we retool our mental health workforce so that we can address problems early in a child's life, which will really, you know, prevent future mental illness. So, but yes, I will say just in my practice, what I'm seeing, especially since school ended, and school was pretty rough here. The distance learning was not great here in Oregon. I don't know if it was great anywhere. It was certainly a, you know, kind of hastily thrown together effort. So I had a lot of kids complaining about school. And now that there's no school and no structure and so many summer activities have been canceled or curtailed, I am seeing just so much anxiety and depression among adolescents. And, you know, it's, you know, with some of the adolescents, it's just like, hey, life is rough and this is how, you know, we're going to get through this. And other kids who are really, really struggling. So getting them in with behavioral health specialists and with therapists. So absolutely. And I think it has, again, persuaded me that I think we got to work really hard to have some version of in-person schooling in the fall, you know, for kids to be back with other kids, you know, in the confines of our public health measures.
And, well, I feel really strongly about that, too. It hurts my heart to know that, like, my kids' friends who don't have brothers or sisters don't have any kids around them. At least my kids have each other. And it just, I know how important that is. Because, you know, the tablets and things, my son tried to talk to some friends on Messenger, and it just didn't work out the way, you know, it would for you and me. Kids don't really do tablet talk the same way that you and I might do if we were Facebook Skyping or something.
Right.
But also in terms of mental health, it feels like there is a breakdown in terms of people's reactions to this disease. I have neighbors, and, you know, I don't want anyone to be sick. I don't want, you know, to wish ill on anyone, but it seems like I'm arguing about, well, how do we address this pandemic? And then there's my neighbors who think there's no pandemic. This is a hoax. And they're just out to get the president, which is why the NBA and NHL and Major League Baseball gave up billions in revenue. You know, just how do you, you know, this is the politics of it. You're going to be a legislator. Like, do you see that widened gulf of just reality, like different realities? And how have you thought about, is that something you're going to have to address in Oregon, or are things just a little bit more sane there?
Things are not a little bit more sane here. We have kind of an urban, rural, Democratic, Republican divide. And, you know, it's certainly very disappointing, kind of confounding how science has become so politicized and how scientific data doesn't seem to account for much anymore. I mean, we had already had glimpses of this with climate change. But the way it's taken hold, and it's been so so horrifically exploited by our president, you know, making people skeptical of science or scientists is really disturbing. And that, like, masks becoming politicized. You know, there has been a real uptick in scientists, including physicians, running for office since 2016. And there's actually neat organizations that kind of provide support for people like me who are running for office. Mm-hmm. And I think it is because we're all feeling like, hey, wait a minute, you know, policy should be based in science, you know, when possible, or at least science should strongly inform policy. And it's discouraging, and it turns out it's deadly when science is ignored by people, I think in large part because of their ideology.
Yeah,
so it's scary.
Right, it's very frustrating. I had to step away. I wasn't even in the conversation, but my next door neighbor was literally talking to his next door neighbor, and our houses are all close, and going off on conspiracy theory after conspiracy theory, and just like, what do I say? Like, I'm just going to have to ignore this because, you know, otherwise I'm going to be in this black hole. But I also,
right.
You know, I don't want to just leave someone hanging that they're going to just believe this, you know, mess forever. It's I don't know if there's an easy way to fix that.
You know, I know, and there's so much being spoken about and written about how we need to, sorry, there's a leaf blower, let me move. So much being written about, you know, reaching across the aisle and trying to find common ground. And, you know, this has been something that's been discussed in the gun violence prevention movement for a long time. So it's sometimes very hard to find common ground when the basic assumptions are so different.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what I come back to is I think most people want to make sure their kids are safe. You know, that's kind of what I've used in gun violence prevention work and in COVID work. And what are we going to do as a society to make sure the kids are safe? And we can usually get on the same page of that. I will say, I think part of the ability to ignore science in COVID for people is that it's, and this is crass and disappointing to admit, but it's old people dying who have medical complications. I think as the numbers get bigger and we start seeing young people dying, I think that might... that might get people's attention. I'm talking about Oregon. We've had very few young people with COVID, although the numbers are definitely climbing right now. I don't think we've had any childhood deaths here. I know there have been in Florida and in New York where the numbers are higher. I think that might be something that allows people to look beyond their ideology to kind of work together to do what we need to do to prevent that from happening.
Yeah, and it does, I mean, I'm sure even though you are a pediatrician focused mostly on children, it hurts my heart, and I'm sure yours too, when people do dismiss the elderly or the sick. I mean, my mom has MS. My dad has a heart condition. I in my professional work, care for people with ALS. Like, am I supposed to just ignore their health forever?
No, it's very disturbing. Yeah.
So this has also obviously changed your campaign as well. How have you been able, you talked about how you're putting information out there. Are you changing up how you're reaching out to voters and still feeling effective?
Yeah, so we had a very crowded Democratic primary for this seat on May 19th. And so, and I started my campaign last November. So I had a really aggressive plan for door knocking.
Right.
And I'm glad we started early because before we had to stop door knocking, we knocked on 6,000 doors and we're planning on knocking on, like, I don't know, 18,000. And so obviously we had to change course. We took some time off because I think everyone was so shook up. And then slowly we started calling voters, just my campaign manager and I, and people were really receptive. I think they were a little lonely. I think they were definitely scared. So having a physician call them, you know, and ask them questions, I think was great. And then we were able to, as people felt more comfortable that we weren't, you know, that things are at least stable in Oregon, with a group of amazing volunteers, most of whom I met through Moms Demand Action, we made phone calls to 14,000 voters, and we sent handwritten postcards to 8,000 voters. And we, and of course I had the, you know, you have to have a few glossy mailings. So we had to really, it was very sad for me to give up canvassing. I love canvassing. I love walking the neighborhoods. I got to know the district so much better. But we just had to really change course in it, and it ended up working out okay. And, you know, most people hate phone banking, but phone banking and COVID is so much more rewarding. And we really had some great conversations on the phones.
Yeah.
And I think that's what the, I mean, I don't anticipate being able to knock doors before the November election, my general election. So I think it will be kind of more of the same.
Well, and maybe this is one of those things that's going to improve the odds for people like you and other Democrats who are taking this seriously. Because if someone came to my door, I might not open it.
Right.
But I would answer mail or a phone call. And so the campaigns that adapt to COVID and take it seriously might have better results.
Yeah, I think people would be very put off right now by a stranger coming to their door, you know? So I don't, like I said, I think canvassing certainly right now doesn't make sense. I can't even decide if it would be considered appropriate. But legal, I'm using air quotes under the current our current phase of opening, but I just don't think it feels appropriate. But yeah, you're right. We can reach people through other means.
Yeah. I have knocked on thousands of doors since my first campaign, in 2002. And I miss it. I want to go door knocking so bad.
You know? I know. It is really, really, I really enjoyed it. And like I said, I really got to know the district a lot better. Mm-hmm. I really, really miss it. Sometimes when I would phone bank, I would click on the address and I would say, oh, what I wouldn't give to walk the hills of that neighborhood right now.
Right. Yeah.
You know, so yeah.
I go on walks in our neighborhood. We have a very walkable town, and sometimes I see people outside and I'm like, oh, this is the closest I can get. This is great. And I can have a conversation where I'm basically yelling at them from 10 feet away.
Yes. Yeah.
Now, even with all these challenges, not just in campaigning, but the kind of challenges you're going to have to take on, why would you encourage other people to run for office wherever they are, whether it's the state legislature or otherwise? Why is it important to get people involved in running for office now and in the future?
Yeah, thank you. Great question. You know, I know that Oregon, and I suspect a lot of state legislatures have this as their goal. I mean, we really try to pride ourselves on having a citizen legislature, mm-hmm. so that it's not professional politicians serving in office at all sorts of levels, that it's people who've been out in the world with real world experience. And I think bringing that perspective into the state house is really important. And so I'm really excited about that. I think that I'm really, really glad I won. I really ran to win. But if I hadn't won, I still would have said, that was an incredibly valuable experience. Mm-hmm. I met a lot of amazing people who are now my friends. I delved into issues that I might not have delved as deeply because they weren't in my professional realm, like environmental issues. I understand way better now than I did when I got into this race in November. I understand the process so much better. And so it, just the process itself, I'm sure you know, is just really, really valuable. But of course, to serve and to represent your neighbors is quite an honor, and to do it bringing your real world experience and perspective, I think, is very, very valuable.
Yeah, every vote feels like an honor. It's so weird that someone.
Oh yeah.
Did it feel when you won or when you found out people that you didn't know voted for you? Isn't it kind of a weird experience in a way? Like, really? You okay? Great.
Yes, and I, you know, leading up to Election Day, I saw a woman on the street. She's like, oh, I voted for you. And I remember, I'm like, oh, you're the, I remembered I had knocked on her door. Mm-hmm. Yes, it was a really heady experience, and obviously I don't know everyone who voted for me, and it's really powerful. It's a real honor, and I take it very, very seriously that people are putting their trust in me.
Yeah, I agree, and that's usually the question I end on, but the way you answered it made me want to ask something else. Do you feel like, had you not won, and I'm glad you did too, because we need more healthcare experts in government, especially now, but you had worked on these issues in some way, shape, or form, especially with gun violence, with Moms Demand Action. Do you think that now, if you had to go and be an advocate for those things, that regardless of this election, you would be a stronger advocate for those issues?
Yes, I think so. Thank you. I think you just understand better what the process looks like. You even understand better what legislators go through in order to, gain public office. I had a lot of legislators who were very generous with their time with me when I was running to help me understand, the process. So I think I would have been a better advocate, absolutely.
And I know that people like to think that if you know politics, you become more cynical. And that might be true in a lot of respects. But in a way, doesn't it make you less cynical? Because now you understand that, no, people didn't vote this way just because they got a check. Like, there are reasons people voted these ways, and that's how you become effective.
Right. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Most of the legislators, and I've talked to several more since I won this primary, really good hearts, really smart, really honest. Even if I don't agree with them, I've been pretty impressed with most of the legislators I've spoken with.
Yeah, I think that I really don't like the attitude in politics, well, from other people, that all politicians are bad. There are bad people in anything, and maybe more so in politics than in other professions. But I would love to think that people go into this for the good reasons, and it's obvious that you have too. Dr. Lisa Reynolds, if people want to follow you and learn more about your campaign, about what you're doing, about your issues, where can they go to follow you and learn more?
Everything's kind of Lisa for Oregon, and all letters, not the number, so LISAFOROREGON, and that's my website, www.lisafororegon.com, my Facebook page, my Instagram handle, I think you call it, and my Twitter handle are all Lisa for Oregon.
Well, Lisa, you are my first very cool person I've gotten to talk to from Oregon. I wish you the best of luck, but hopefully you won't be the last very cool person I talk to from Oregon in one way or another. So I wish you the best of luck.
We have a lot of cool Oregonians, yes.
Oh, that's a cool name, Oregonians. That's better than some other names. My wife is from Rhode Island. Rhode Islanders isn't as cool as Oregonians. That's neat. So please follow Lisa on social media. Go to our website to learn more. And if you are listening and you feel like there's an issue that's not being taken care of in your area, maybe you should run for office too. Thank you, Lisa, and best of luck.
Thank you, Tony. This is really a pleasure. Thank you so much.